Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, history is full of great cliches and old sayings and, about history repeating itself and people who don't learn from the lessons of history, etc. And it certainly seems in many ways that here we are, there again. I spent most of the day yesterday afternoon going through the archives of the New York Times from 1928, 29, 30, 31, and 32. And I just have some amazing stuff to share with you this morning in the first and second hours of our program. In the third hour of our program, Naomi Klein is going to drop by this morning, or this afternoon, wherever you may be in the United States, talking about the shock doctrine, and that should be an interesting conversation. Right now, Chuck Collins is with us. He's the senior – oh, and I should say – by the way, greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Chuck Collins is the senior scholar at the Institute for Public Studies, where he coordinates the working group on extreme inequality. Extremeinequality.org is the website. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back here with us. You, in addition to the marvelous work that you've done on things like the estate tax over the years and other things, some so solid economic stuff. And you and Sarah Anderson, John Kavanaugh, who's also been on this program, Derek Muhammad, and Sam Pizzagatti, who's been on the program, have come up with Responding to Main Street, a Sensible Plan for Recovery. This is from the Institute for Policy Studies. Sorry, I got the name wrong there at the beginning. Tell us about this, Chuck.
Well, I think that the blowback, that the popular suspicion toward this bailout package is rooted in a rational impulse, you know, that the Bush administration is trying to push through a bailout that that really doesn't solve the underlying problem of the housing bubble and is unaccountable. And so in listening and working with members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and just talking to a lot of grassroots groups, we've come up with a plan that basically, I think, you know, there probably will be some bailout that will occur in the next week. So what would be the conditions that progressives should be concerned about? And one is just making sure there's an economic, a fiscal stimulus, a Main Street stimulus that helps with, you know, the sort of bottom-up bailout, getting money into local communities, helping the real economy as opposed to the casino economy.
Right.
And then a plan to pay for it fairly by making sure that Wall Street covers the costs. I think there are a couple other provisions just that, make sure there's not profiteering, from the organizations that are involved in any kind of bailout. So those are the kinds of conditions that, progressives should be insisting. Otherwise, I don't think we should back this deal.
One of the things that, I'm not a recent student of the Great Depression, but this was the first time I've actually sat down with the New York Times archives and just went through story after story after story after story, day after day, looking at what was going on. And you know, I think one of the great lessons of the Great Depression was that Herbert Hoover in 1931 put together what, you know, became the organization ultimately that pulled us out of the Great Depression. But it had to be rebooted by Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, Hoover was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and you know, this was put together in 1931, but he was aggressively fighting against using the RFC to bail out individuals, pick up mortgages, rebuild the country, anything like that. It was exclusively to give money to banks, and then later on, grudgingly, he allowed them to give money to railroads. Because he felt that they were essential for national commerce, sort of like the airlines of today being bailed out. But that was about it. It was entirely a top-down, a trickle-down approach. And it seems to me that the biggest problem that we have, setting aside the housing bubble, which we can't ignore, there was a housing bubble that burst in 1927 as well that many argued led directly to 1929. But even in that context is that economies work from the bottom up, not from the top down.
No, I think this is a very important lesson. I mean, part of what's the problem is we've had three decades of growth that have been bubble-driven, debt-driven, rather than wage-driven. So similar to 1929, we're about as unequal of a society as we've been since then.
Right.
The concentration of wealth, and at the bottom end, the stagnation of wages and the collapse of buying power. So the way the middle class participated in the economy for the last 15 years has been borrowing against their homes, borrowing on credit cards, rather than seeing their real wages go up.
Right. Much like, by the way, the middle class was participating in the late 20s, from 25 to 29, there was through this land speculation and this huge housing bubble that went on. All these people were taking out 5-year balloon mortgages because that was the norm back then, and they couldn't pay them. And you had people who were borrowing to buy stock. I mean, you had taxi drivers buying stock on margin.
And at the very top of the economy, you had people with tremendous concentrated wealth who were saying, well, geez, we just don't want these small returns, 5% returns. We want really big returns. And so there's a lot of money being pushed into the betting, gambling, casino aspects of the economy. So there's wild speculation at the top and stagnant wages on the bottom. And that's always been the recipe for instability.
So looking at the package that the Senate Democratic leadership is putting together right now, apparently in collaboration and cooperation with the Republicans, it looks like everybody wants to get something through. The Democrats want to get something through because they really want to do what's right for the country. The Republicans hysterically want to get something through because they want to hold off an even worse collapse until after November 4th so that they can blame it on the election of a Democrat if and when it happens. What are your thoughts on what actually is going to happen versus what you're proposing, and how do we push to have what you're proposing become, which, you know, the basics, the sensible plan for recovery, you can see it over at the Institute for Policy Studies website or extremeinequality.org. Stimulus for Main Street, make Wall Street speculators pay for the bailout. This includes the 0.25% tax, does it, on transactions?
That's right. Yeah.
Shut down the casino and limits on CEO pay, real limits, as opposed to limits on tax deductibility.
That's right, yeah. Well, I think what's going to happen is that the Senate will probably, because they are they're somewhat buffered from the election, and they will pass a deal. It will probably include some ridiculous tax cuts for business, which have nothing
right.
to do with this.
Yeah, only a third of senators are up for reelection right now.
Yeah. And then it will move to the House. And that's where I think there are active debates right now about what the progressives should hold out for. It was interesting. The Progressive Caucus, 70 members, half of them voted for the bailout bill, half of them voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're talking about, well, what are the conditions for us to get in this? And one of them is this securities transaction tax. It's something you've written about, and I've seen
mm-hmm.
others, and we've put out some papers saying, yeah, let's impose a modest tax on the sale and transfer of stocks and other financial instruments, put it into this stimulus fund or bailout fund,
right?
Make Wall Street pay. It's yep. elegant.
Peter DeFazio is the big advocate for that in the House of Representatives, and we talked to them yesterday, and it looks like, you know, he had a whole bunch of traction. He had a bunch of people saying, "Yeah, yeah, let's do this," and then the House leadership brought in, was it Marcy Kaptur?
Yep.
As I recall, she was one of Clinton's big, you know, top economic gurus. And now she's on the board of Bear or Lehman or something. It couldn't be Bear, but I guess Lehman. And she said, oh, no, the Wall Street won't like that. All of a sudden, the support for it just evaporated.
Well, they basically punted on any mechanism to pay for it other than adding it to the debt.
Right.
So I think there's some pushback there. I think there's that should be one of the conditions. Certainly, clearly a Main Street stimulus, as you're saying, a bottom-up stimulus.
Yeah. Carl Wolfson here on KPOJ on the morning show spoke with Earl Blumenauer, our congressman from Portland, Oregon. and a Democrat who voted against the bill yesterday, a progressive Democrat. And he said he felt that, that just largely changes in regulation could deal with much of this, as opposed to giving $700 billion to banks. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there's a lot more. Well, certainly in the longer term, there's a whole, re-regulate, shut down the casino, and put restrictions. But there is a short-term credit crisis, and there is a lot of disagreement even among friends as to whether some timely action should be taken soon. I guess I'm in the camp that some action should be taken, and we should get as much conditions as possible put on it.
Yeah. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Chuck Collins, the senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, extremeinequality.org, the website. A Sensible Plan for Recovery, Responding to Main Street is the report. Chuck, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back. I got to share these New York Times. This is incredible.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Trouble, come on in. You talk about heartaches, where in the world you been? I ain't had the miseries since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, 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 welcome home.
Well, let's see, speaking of trouble, Michelle Balkin on August 8th, that was when the National Enquirer was talking about John Edwards, you'll recall, was pretty enthusiastically in supporting the National Enquirer. In fact, Jonah Goldberg from the National Review said the following. It's worth pointing out that while the National Enquirer may or may not be scrupulous in its choice of stories, that's in the eye of the beholder, it is pretty scrupulous about its facts. They win lawsuits. They've broken a host of stories the mainstream media guys couldn't. Jonah Goldberg. Well, maybe we should listen to him and go out and buy this the current issue of National Enquirer, which has an article in it about Sarah Palin having an affair with her husband's business partner. Roger Ebert says, I do not like you, John McCain. My feeling has nothing to do with issues. It has to do with common courtesy. During the debate, you refused to look Barack Obama in the eye. Indeed, you refused to look at him at all. Even when the two of you shook hands at the start, you used your eyes only to locate his hand and then gazed past him as you shook it. Did you notice? I noticed this watching the debate. But I didn't realize it was so systemic that it went all the way through the entire debate, that never once did John McCain look Barack Obama in the eye. Roger Ebert says, Obama's my guy. If you're rude to him, you're rude to me. If you come to dinner at my house and refuse to look at or speak to one of my guests, that would be bad manners, and I'd be offended. Same thing if I went to your house. During the debate, you were America's guest. What's your problem? Do you hold this man in such contempt you cannot bear to gaze upon him? Will you not even speak to him directly? Do you think he doesn't have the right to be running for president? This is so well done. By the way, it was Laura Tyson was the woman who came and testified before the House Democrats, and about the I mixed her up with Marcy Kaptur, who's the brilliant congresswoman who has been pointing out some of this stuff. Anyhow, the Financial Times today. This is startling, actually. Above the fold, top of the page, two stories. There's two stories that are the top half of today's front page of the USA edition of the Financial Times. Now that the Wall Street Journal has become a Rupert Murdoch voice mouthpiece, basically we're left with the Financial Times. The big headline, crisis deepens despite rally. Overnight interbank lending rates reach painfully high levels. They point out that this is called the LIBOR rate. LIBOR, and it's the rate that banks charge each other for loans overnight, and it jumped 4.3% to a 7-year high of 6.88%. Now keep in mind, back in August, it was in the neighborhood of around 2%, and so this is not a good thing. Bottom line, just not a good thing, and it's really spiking. But then they go on beyond that. This is the other story that's at the top of the front page. Demand surges for gold investors can hold. Now, this really got my attention, not because I'm you know, some kind of gold bug or something. I do think it's probably a reasonable thing to have as a small part of your portfolio, but listen to this. This is Javier Blas in Kyoto. This is the second most important story in the Financial Times today. It's right at the top of page one. Investors in gold are demanding unprecedented, in quotes, physical levels of bullion bars and coins and moving them into their own vaults as fears about the global financial system deepen. Now, they're pointing out these are not people like you and me. These are people who actually own their own vaults. Industries executives and bankers at the London Bullion Market Association annual meeting today said the extent of the move into physical gold was unforeseen and driven by the very rich. Jeremy Charles, chairman of the LBMA, said there was an enormous pickup in investment demand. I have never seen a market like this in my 33-year career. The gold refineries cannot produce enough bars. Another banker at the LBMA meeting said vault staff are also working overtime. Well, that's pretty amazing. Now, some of the alternative rescue plans and some of the rescue plans, one of the suggestions is to suspend the what's called the mark-to-market or fair value accounting rules. And on page two of the Financial Times, they talk about, you know, the problems with these things. Jennifer Hughes notes, regulators, investors, accountants who've largely opposed changing the rules don't think this is a good idea. They believe it would make banks' holdings less transparent and thereby introduce new investor suspicion and distrust, meaning asset values, including bank stocks, could fall further still. Or the other alternative is it makes it less transparent and we reinflate a bubble and we are stuck back again with a phony bubble. Another one is to take equity stakes in Wall Street companies. And they say this could neutralize the criticism that taxpayers are bailing out Wall Street without getting the upside. This is what Sweden did, by the way, and it worked quite well for them. Thank you very much. It's what the UK just did with BlackRock. But as they point out in the Financial Times, if the Republicans in the House of Representatives regard the Treasury buying toxic assets as too close to financial socialism, they are likely to balk even more at the government taking over the banks themselves. And then finally, the idea of cutting capital gains taxes. This doesn't seem to be playing very well either. So anyhow, we'll get back to all these things right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
3 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And some stuff is just downright crazy, I'm telling you out there. Well, the headline in the Financial Times, page 4, fears of slide into world recession gain momentum. So Philip Proctor sends me this. Following the problems in the subprime lending market in America and problems in the UK, uncertainty has now hit Japan. In the last 7 days, Origami Bank has folded, Sumo Bank has gone belly up, and Bonsai Bank announced plans to cut some of its branches. Yesterday, it was announced the Karaoke Band is a bank is up for sale and will likely go for a song, and while shares in Kamikaze Bank were suspended after they nosedived. While Samurai Bank is soldiering on following sharp cutbacks, Ninja Bank is reported to have taken a hit, but they remain in the black. Furthermore, 500 stocks at Karate Bank got the chop, and analysts report that there is something fishy going on at Sushi Bank, where it is feared that staff may get a raw deal. Yeah, that's a little tongue-in-cheek. This is actually a real one. John Grady Pippen didn't look pregnant. He's 71 years old. He went to the hospital, Curry General Hospital in Gold Beach, and he didn't read the discharge instruction. He had abdominal pain, right? They gave him pain pills and paperwork to explain his delicate condition. Didn't read the discharge instructions until the next day. Based on your visit today, the paperwork informed him, the 71-year-old man, we know you are pregnant, but the exact cause of your abdominal pain is not certain. Some pain or bleeding may occur in a normal pregnancy, but this may also be a sign of miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy, a very serious condition. Yeah. And here's another, this in the crazy category, but this is a serious story. This is from the Times Online. Headline, CEO murdered by mob of fired Indian workers or sacked Indian workers. Corporate India is in shock after a mob of workers bludgeoned to death the chief executive who fired them from a factory in the suburbs of Delhi. Lalit Kishore Chandri, 47, the head of the Indian operations of Grazzano Trasmissioni, a manufacturer of car parts with his headquarters in Italy, died of severe head wounds on Monday after being attacked by scores of laid-off employees. Other executives said that they were lucky to escape with their lives. One Italian consultant told reporters, I locked my door from inside and prayed they would not break in. See, my hands are trembling even 3 hours later. Now, you remember when George W. Bush said, famously said,
if this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What is it about whack job Republicans and wanting to be a dictator? Here's John McCain yesterday.
Line of credit, they're seeing that cut off. I mean, this is just a not acceptable situation. I'm not saying this is the perfect answer. If I were dictator, which I always aspire to be, I would write it very different, a little bit differently. I would have.
Yeah, if he were a dictator, which he always aspires to be, he'd write it a little bit differently. Yeah. I got at the top of the next hour, I'm just gonna start on October 26th, 1929, and take you through. What's the last one I have here? July 10th, 1932, and give you a little bit of history, reading from the archives of the New York Times at the top of the next hour. But right now, let's pick up some of your calls. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ken in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. My big problem is this. Even if there's intervention needed to avoid a crisis, I am 100% sure that any money given to the executive branch will be used solely to help out, you know, their buddies, and any positive effect to the American people will be solely incidental. So my question is this. Why doesn't Congress come out and tell the American people, listen, we are going to bring in Bernanke and Paulson, and since they say they need the money now, they must know at least how they're going to want to use the first couple hundred billion. Ask them, what do you want to do with that money? Then convene a panel of economic experts, including them, put everything on C-SPAN, and say, okay, guarantee the American people, within the next 2 weeks, we are going to put 150 to 200 billion into the system, but it's going to be completely transparent, and we're going to have a bunch of the top heads in the country on this. And I think the American people would go for that, and then the money could actually be used, and you know, and stick in that part about letting people go to the bankruptcy judges and you know, renegotiate mortgages. But anyway, what do you think about that?
Ken, I think you make an excellent point, and it just ain't going to happen. And it ain't going to happen because, A, what the Republicans are trying to do is buy time until November 4th. They so desperately want this thing to look like it's patched up, and then after November 4th have the bottom fall out once Barack Obama is elected president of the United States. I guarantee you that's the top-of-mind thing for the Republicans. They're just buying time. They don't give a damn what it takes, and if they can get a couple of sweeteners in there, that's fine. You know, more tax breaks for the wealthy and for the corporations.
What could they do if the Democratic leaders went to the American people and said, this is what we want to do?
The problem with the Democratic leaders doing anything, Ken, is that the Democratic leadership, A, is not all that progressive itself, and B, the Democratic Party, there is such a large chunk of the Democratic Party that is not only not progressive but is conservative that, you know, that if that chunk, the Blue Dog Democrats, by and large, if they were to desert the Democratic Party, there's no longer a majority, a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. Not that they would leave the party to go to the Democrat, but I'm talking about voting with them. So the problem is that a true progressive solution, a true Franklin Roosevelt solution, right now is outside the range of the political will of Congress. Because Congress doesn't have enough progressives in it. And that's one of the things that we all have to be working on, being sure that we get progressives elected to office this fall. It's not just the president. And also pushing Barack Obama in a more progressive direction once he's elected, just like we the people pushed Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 in a progressive direction when he was inaugurated as president after the election of 32. Mark in Tennessee, thanks for the call. Mark in Tennessee. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. I read an article recently that purported to explain the reason why John McCain couldn't look Obama in the eye during the debate. And I think I read the article through the Josh Marshall's PPM website. Mm-hmm. And in the article, it said that during the meeting in the White House with congressional leaders just before the debate over the bailout situation, Barack Obama was the voice for the Democratic contingent, and Boehner was speaking for the Republicans.
Right. Now, on a couple of occasions, Barack Obama said directly to John McCain, "What do you think about that, John? Here's my thoughts on it, blah, blah, blah. What do you think about that, John?" And John
exactly.
McCain
That's
refused
him,
to look at him.
In a position where he had to either side with Boehner, who was against the bailout plan, or with the president.
No, Boehner was in favor of it. Boehner was in favor of it. Boehner thought they had a deal. He was walking in. He thought the thing was going to happen.
I thought that happened later. I thought during the meeting at the White House, Boehner still had reservations on the plan, and the president was for it, and that put John McCain in the middle, having to make a decision within the party.
Well, that might have happened midstream in the meeting, but I think you've got the order reversed. The debate happened before the meeting in the White House, at the debate where John McCain refused to look Barack Obama in the eye. I mean, that happened several days before. Oh, no, you're right. You're right. Wait a minute.
Yeah, well, McCain jumped on his plane and went to the debate directly after the meeting.
No, you're right. You're right. The meeting in the White House was that morning.
Right, and he wanted to sit there quietly and let Boehner speak for him, but Obama put him on the spot.
Right.
And when the debate happened, he was still fuming over that incident.
Yeah. Interesting theory, Mark. Interesting theory. Thanks for sharing that with me. Let me ponder that for a bit. Chuck in Illinois. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Oh, hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make two points. The primary issue I wanted to make, primary point, was it's pretty apparent that most of our congressmen and senators are not listening to the phone calls they're receiving.
Of them are that they defeated this bill the day before yesterday. I mean, it's... But,
well, I mean, that is true. That is true. But the reason I say that is because the revised bill doesn't really show anything that is going to be effective in controlling this mess and preventing it from happening the next time.
Right.
I called my senators, which is Obama and Durbin, and Jerry Weller, who's my congressman, and they took my calls, they listened, which I appreciate, but they come out with a bill, they rename it to us. And they call it a rescue plan now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say it, and then they say that they didn't communicate effectively.
Right.
When all across America, there's demonstrations going on with people picketing, saying limit CEO pay,
right.
Repeal the Graham bill. And what do we get? We get a revised bill that's renamed so that they can market it to us, which is true. That's true to the Republican Party. Let's advertise to the people than actually perform for the people.
Yeah.
And here we sit with a vote that's going to take place tonight in the Senate, and it might pass. Mm-hmm. And this is not going to solve our problem down the road.
No, it's not. This is the Bush administration and their buddies leaving the White House and taking the china and the silverware with them. That's what it is. You've got a deal being put together by an investment banker, and you know Abe Maslow, the famous psychologist, came up with has said once said if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, You've got an investment banker who's come up with an investment banker solution for a problem that is not based on investment banker problems. This is a problem that has to do with the fact that wages have been falling in the United States for 30 years. It's a problem that has to do, Chuck, thank you very much for the call. It has to do with the destruction of the middle class in the United States, the fact that for the last 20 years, increasingly, average Americans, in order to survive, have had to live on credit. We have this entire system that has been driven by credit. And then on top of that, you have this right-wing ideology of deregulation and blowing up transparency. That's the cause of this.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
I've learned when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights to stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions.
9.5 minutes before the hour.
Because the union.
Here, I'm looking at this article in the Houston Chronicle from a couple of days ago. 2 weeks after Ike, more than 400 are still missing. They start out telling the story of Gail Ettinger, who was calling a friend of hers. She was trapped in the Bolivar Peninsula in her bungalow with her Great Dane Reba. A drowning cat cried outside. Her Jeep bobbed in the seawater, surging around her home. She's calling her friend and told her that she says, I think I really screwed up this time. She was reading old love letters by flashlight. That was Friday, September 12th. On Wednesday, 12 days later, her nearly nude body was found face down by a huge debris pile in a remote mosquito-ridden marsh in Chambers County, about 10 miles inland from where her gray beach house once stood. 2 weeks after Hurricane Ike swept through the Texas coast, 400 people remain missing. And I don't know if it's still in place or not, but the federal government had imposed this no-fly zone over that for a long, long time. It's like the Bush administration, again, did not want us to see bodies floating after a hurricane. There on the blogosphere, as it were, on the web out there, there's a little bit of a buzz going on right now about how John McCain got confused and lost on stage, got lost trying to get off stage apparently today. And if you check out the blog americablog.com, they say, you know, in the post below, we showed a scene that just took place, this is today, in which McCain was momentarily confused on stage, not knowing where to go. We posted the video because we thought it was funny. But Joe just realized that literally seconds before McCain became confused on stage, his face twitched or convulsed twice. Look at the photos above. You can see it. It happened twice, first in a rather major way at 5 seconds, then more minor at 10 or 11 seconds. His left eye twitched closed. At the same time, the left corner of his lip twitched upwards, especially pronounced. What's going on with John McCain? Did he just have a stroke on television, on national TV? This is spooky stuff. There are all these doctors, and I believe that we will be talking on Friday again with Robert Greenwald about this. All these physicians who are calling for a complete release of McCain's medical records, and we're not getting them. And we need to know, you know, what's the deal with John McCain? Andre in Washington, D.C. Hey, Andre, what's on your mind today?
Hey, 2 points. First things first, McCain and not looking Obama in the eyes. I mean, if this is the guy who says he's going to bring bipartisanship back to Washington, D.C., I mean, there's just no way. I mean, you can't look the man in the eye and shake his hand. I mean, how are you going to reach across the aisle and, you know, resolve differences between the other parties? And my last question to you, in terms of a theory, if you will, when should politicians not listen to their constituents when they believe it's for the greater good? I mean, I know a lot of folks are writing to politicians and say, you know, don't vote for this particular bill. And I'm not just talking about this bill. You know, we could talk about anything.
Sure.
But when does a politician say, I have to, right now my constituents aren't aware of the, I guess, the long-term impact?
The short answer to your question, Andre, is in all cases, because the oath that our elected representatives take, the oath of office that they take, is not an oath to do what their constituents tell them to do. Although we do elect representatives in this country, as I love to point out, not leaders, the oath that they take is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. So if they genuinely and truly believe that the Constitution is under assault, even if the people are clamoring for something, they should not go along with the will of the people. I mean, you know, the will of the majority of the people in the United States at one point in time, for a long time during the history of this country, was in favor of slavery. The will of the people in the United States for the majority of the history of this country was that women not be allowed to vote. We have a long history of bizarre things that the majority of the people were in favor of, that it took courageous legislators standing up to the people to say, no, we're not going to do this, particularly in parts of the country where, you know, I would argue that even there are some places in this country where those two sentiments, among others, are still held by some of the people. And so maybe not quite that bluntly, but you get my point.
Sure.
So I think that, you know, legislators have to balance that. And it's got to be a tremendously tense balancing act between what they believe is the right thing to do for the country, what they know is the politically appropriate thing to do, and what they think is going to appropriately represent their constituents. It's got to be a tough one. It's got to be a really tough one. But that's the bottom line, is that they have to do what is in their minds consistent with the Constitution. Andre, excellent question. Thank you for calling and asking it. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, happy New Year to my Semitic friends and everybody else. Thank you very much. This privatization of reward followed by the socialization of risk, provides, I think, a great educational opportunity, a teaching moment for the public for some retrospective rectification that Hoover leads right to Reagan, which leads to Bush Jr., you know, the Great Depression, the savings and loan debacle, and now this. They're showing polls down here in Florida that people have switched way over to Obama after that debate and seeing the mess that they've made of these instruments, this financialization of risk that they're trying to pull on us now. And to just, Reagan's been apotheosized, you know, like this deity, and to see that the savings and loan crisis, which came at the end of his regime, the spendthrift regime, and now here we are again, that this is a straight line, that this is what the Republicans do when they get their hands on power for a while.
And by the way, it's what they did in 1921 as well.
Yep.
You had three consecutive Republican administrations from 1920 to 1921, the election of 1920, until 1933, the election of 1932. And they did the exact same thing. They deregulated, they backed away, they threw easy money, they had crony capitalism, and it led directly to the Great Depression, and now it's leading to another one, in my opinion. Charlie, thank you. Very well said. Very well said. I want to share with you what was actually happening in the news, starting in 1929. We'll start with October 26, 1929. And I think you'll find it interesting. I found it fascinating. Right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, HearAmerica.com for our live free video stream and audio streams. Okay, let's look at the New York Times. The reason why I want to share with you this arc of history from the New York Times from the 1920s and the 1930s is because I believe we're seeing history repeat itself. You know, Strauss and Howe wrote this book called The Fourth Turning. We had, I believe it was Strauss on the program, must have been 4 years ago. They wrote this book like a decade ago, in which they suggested that there are these four generations, these cycles that go on, and basically You have a generation its experience is forged in the crucible of depression and war, and they are followed by a generation that quietly and slowly rebuilds the country, and they are followed by a generation that rejects the notion of quiet nose to the grindstone and says, no, I want to become spiritually enlightened, and they rebel. And then that's followed by a generation that says, to hell with all this spiritual stuff, I want to make money and get rich. And then their wretched excesses, getting rich, causes another depression and a war. And it starts all over again. And they pointed out, and they wrote this book in the 1990s, predicting the next Great Depression to be in the mid-2000s, the early 2000s, right now. And, you know, between 2000 and 2010. And they pointed out that 80 years ago, four generations ago, was the last Great Depression. 80 years before that was the Great Depression of the 1850s and 1860s that led to the Civil War. 80 years before that was the Great Depression of the 1760s that led to the Revolutionary War. 80 years before that, as I recall, was the Great Depression of the 1690s. What was it? The War of the Roses. There was a Great Depression. They go all the way back to like the 1400s or something in this book. I don't have it in front of me, but it's really quite extraordinary. That's one way of looking at it, that this is just, you know, this is how it happened. Another way, and that we're sort of captives of the cycles of history or of culture. Another one is that when the last of the people who really remember how it was die off or are so old that they're really not part of the media debate anymore or discussion, that memory is gone and then people go nuts. And so Phil Graham comes out and says, oh, yeah, you know, in 1933, they passed Glass-Steagall and regulated the banks and said you can't have banks gambling. But we're going to do away with that in 1998 with Graham Leach Bliley. And on it goes. And so, you know, basically the insanity is repeated. And this is what the Republicans did in the 1920s, was they repeated the insanity of the 1850s, which accompanied the collapse of the Federalist Party. And the rise of the Whig Party, which followed the collapse of the Federalists, and accompanied the rise of the new Republican Party, which filled that vacuum. So anyhow, I wanted to just visit some of this stuff. The stock market, here we are, October 27th. And the market had been had been wobbling for a week or two, pretty severely. The headline: market grossly overbought, consensus of economists, bankers, and brokers. All are optimistic again. This is October 27. Wall Street is allowing its imagination full rein in explaining the recent... And some of these, sometimes, I'm sorry, the type on this, you print these archives and I've got literally 4-point type here. Wall Street is allowing its imagination full rein in explaining the recent debacle in the security exchanges, but the substance of all opinions, as boiled down yesterday, was that the break was precipitated by the market's most obvious weakness, a grossly overbought condition. In other words, prices were inflated. In fact, they go on to say, bankers, brokers, and economists are all agreed that the market went on the rocks for a brief period, so there was a hiccup on the 26th, and then came the 27th. On the rocks, because speculation for the rise had been carried beyond all limits of safety. Speculation. In taking stock yesterday, the week's events, the financial community was unanimous in its conviction that the market had been overbulled for a long period. Last week's convulsion, it was agreed, was the inevitable culmination of an unparalleled speculative excess. Okay, that's October 27. Here's another one from October 27. No need for alarm in stock shakeup is the headline. Conference board gives data to prove business sound and gaining. Businessmen should not take undue alarm at the recent shakeup in the stock market in light of data compiled by the National Industrial Conference Board and contained in a statement issued yesterday in tax train. The word is a little blurred. No known factor in the field of industrial enterprise gives warrant for the violent fluctuations experienced in the stock market during the past week or the past year, it says. Total flow of business activity in the United States, on the contrary, has been stable and on the increase. And then the quote from the report, stock speculation in the past by something of the psychological effect of such manipulation had more power to influence business sentiment. But the much improved and perfected organization of modern business, this is, what, three days before the Great Depression, before the big crash, there had been a small crash, through the increased use of of conferences between business leaders and ever more accurate, prompt, and varied and better coordinated sources of statistical information has grossly restricted its power, the power of speculators and securities to harm business stability and progress. That's the 27th. Now, also on the 27th, Alfred P. Sloan, the president of General Motors Corporation, is quoted. He says, "The slump on Wall Street is a healthy thing," said Alfred P. Sloan, president of General Motors, just before sailing home on the Mauritania this morning. "It had to come sooner or later, and it's better over." The Mauritania carried a number of other American businessmen who had made hurried last-minute reservations in consequence of Thursday's stock market crash. So this is Friday's paper, Friday, October 27. Mr. Sloan was frank to declare that he did not regard the slump as a catastrophe. "There can be no doubt that the market had been too high in certain things," he said. "Now everybody will get to work instead of cherishing the idea that it is possible to get rich overnight by speculation. However, I think, however, it has been a little dramatic, but when the pendulum once begins to swing, it usually goes too far in one direction or the other." Yeah. And here, this is the news wrap-up and summary from the 27th. "Normal trading conditions were completely restored on the stock exchange yesterday, and Wall Street breathed..." This is Saturday's. The 27th must have been Saturday. "And Wall Street breathed easier. Not only were transactions of average Saturday proportions, but the market seemed to have lost its nervousness. The Times averages last Thursday showed that the loss since September 19th has been about 23%. This compares with about a 10% loss in the last three separate reactions of last March, last December, and June of 1928, and exceeds the 21.5% decline between the middle of February and the end of March 1926. So this market had been swinging around pretty wildly. "Every old stock market record went by the board last week for an entire new set has been set up for future markets to shoot at. Before the worst part of last week's week's break was over, new accounts were being opened in considerable numbers in all the large brokerage houses." Oh, isn't this great? New people coming. "This suggested to brokers that it probably will not be long before those speculators who were wiped out in the late debacle will be replaced by a fresh crop. At one of the leading commission houses, 50 new accounts were opened on Friday," and they go through all this. "It is expected that when the debris is finally swept up, some of the firms will take on new partners. There will be new consolidations and possibly some new partnerships." And, by the way, they also noted on Saturday that that there was a big bonus on Wall Street. "Stock clerks get bonus. A bonus of a week's extra salary will be paid by the stock exchange firm of J.P. Traunstein and Company to its clerks in recognition of extra work resulting from Thursday's record market and the active trading of Friday and yesterday. Many employees of stock exchange firms have worked until the early hours of the morning during the last few days to keep their books up to date." Okay, the 27th, Thursday, Friday, yesterday. Now, this is actually the 27th was a Sunday because 28 was Monday and 29. Okay, here's the 26th. This is the day before. This was the day of a crash. "Some old and threadbare economic theory was dusted off yesterday in Wall Street by persons seeking to account for the unprecedented decline in the security events during the week. Even the theory of the business cycle, which has received little attention by economists since the recession of 1920, was advanced as a possible explanation. One enterprising Broadway house went to the trouble yesterday preparing a formidable list of depression-proof stocks. The break Thursday has been precedented by speculation unequaled in history." And then also, this on the 27th, "Republicans glum on tariff outlook. Regulators fear further cuts in industrial rates with bill failing in session." This is, they're talking about Smoot-Hawley, the Smoot-Hawley tariff bill. "After a week's work on chemical duties, they laid this thing aside because the progressive Republicans seemed more interested than in any others than keeping the bill before the Senate, hoping they can rewrite the rates to bring agriculture closer to parity with industry." It's very interesting. The Gillette and La Follette were working on this thing really hard. So then we get to October 28, 29, 30, 31. Now this is the crash. This is the big crash. And on October 31st, right after the crash, "The drastic readjustment which has taken place in stock market quotations will augment current business hesitation," according to Gage P. Wright. "No major industrial recession is likely, however," he believes. "The condition of general business during the last fortnight has not been marked by any substantial change in developments considered of fundamental importance. The fundamentals are sound," Mr. Wright says. "Authorities do not anticipate an unfavorable influence."
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so in October of 1929, the October 25th, Black Thursday, there was a stock market crash, as it were. It was followed by Friday when the market bounced back a little bit, and then Saturday and Sunday, the 27th and 28th, a lot of commentary on it. Well, it's interesting. And then the 29th was Black Monday, the 30th was Black Tuesday. The 31st, the market bounced back. And this from the Topics in Wall Street from the New York Times, October 31st. Sweeping recovery occurred all through the security markets yesterday. Active banking support, the fact that the biggest men of the country stood ready and willing to put their shoulders to the wheel to right what had developed into a tragic and precarious situation, brought a rally that was characterized by robust vigor. But the highest levels of the day were held, and stocks closed with a strong tone. I'm sorry, I'm trying to read type here. It's smaller than the small print on a vitamin bottle. The fact that the market finally had rallied itself after 3 days of black terror led to the general conclusion in Wall Street last night that the storm has been weathered and that the real worth of stocks as measured by their dividends, earning capacity, and prospects would guide fluctuations in the immediate future rather than the hysterical scrambling to get out. Gains of up to 25 points were established among all the lines yesterday on the stock exchange and the curb. The leaders in the recovery were United States Steel, Allied Chemical and Dye, American Can, General Electric, General Motors, IT&T, and AT&T, and Montgomery Ward. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Think of John McCain. And by the way, Warren Buffett talking about how he's buying $5 billion worth of stock in Goldman Sachs. Listen to this. Public statements by the country's biggest and most influential men that the fundamentals of the country are entirely sound. I'm reading to you verbatim from the New York Times, October 29, 1929. Public statements by the country's biggest and most influential men that the fundamentals of the country are entirely sound and the stocks at present levels have reached a point where buying for investment is warranted probably aided the situation as much as any other single factor. These men not only talked, they bought stocks. The authorized statement that John D. Rockefeller and his son were buying stocks synchronized closely with the day's sharpest upturn and attracted the more attention because of the rare occasions on which Mr. Rockefeller has permitted direct quotation and never before on a stock market affair. Now, did Rockefeller actually buy stocks? Nobody knows. He issued a news release saying he was buying stocks. The stock market went back up. Maybe that was an opportunity for him to sell and get out. They go on to note, the biggest crash in the history of the stock market is likely to leave a long trail of disputes, arguments, and possibly lawsuits. And then they say one of the most constructive developments of yesterday being Black Tuesday, was the tremendous amount of odd lot buying for cash. It represented an overnight change in sentiment of great importance to the market and was construed as recognizing the fact that many stocks in the wild scramble to sell had been depressed to too low levels. Many a strong box was replenished with securities yesterday at levels that now look attractive. Here's this also, this big drop expected in brokers' loans. Now, here's where we see, bring in the Fed. Again, this is from the New York Times. This is from October 31. As a result of the terrific slash in security prices to the accompaniment of record-breaking turnovers, bankers are expecting a reduction in brokers' loans to be announced this afternoon, which will far exceed any hitherto recorded. In other words, they're not going to loan money to people to buy stock. In meeting the crisis of the stock exchange, local banks have had the full cooperation of the Federal Reserve, which has been steadily pumping credit into the market during the past few days by the wholesale purchase of government securities. Sound familiar? In the last week, there's been heavy calling of loans by corporations and wealthy individuals. In part, however, it has been the result of a sudden realization that it is not always safe for non-banking institutions to usurp the function of banks. Gee, tell that to Senator Graham, would you please? In large part, however, the liberal attitude shown by the Federal Reserve, in building up its portfolio through purchases of government securities has supplied the market with its needed funds. Yeah. Then we jump to 1931. Let's go from the crash. That was the crash. Let's go to 1931, We're Herbert Hoover now. We're now in the depths of the Great Depression, 2 years after the crash. Keep in mind the market collapsed steadily and slowly for the next 2 years, for the next year, and hit a point in 31 where if you invested money in 1931, you didn't see a return on that investment basically until the next generation. Or if you invested money in 2029, really, for that matter. The headline, Real Estate Men on the Hoover Plan. And this is October 18th, 1931. Skepticism as to President Hoover's plan to liquidate frozen bank assets was expressed yesterday by Charles G. Edwards, president of the Real Estate Securities Exchange. This is when Roosevelt, or when Hoover, rather, came before the country and said, we need to bail out the banks. We want to create an agency to do it. I'll tell you all about that right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Well, my face may not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. And just a heads up, on Friday of this week, I'll be doing the show live from KPTR AM 1480 in Palm Springs. And that Friday night and Saturday, I'll be giving the keynote speech at the Evolution of Revolution conference, Shining Dawn's Early Light on Spirit, Science, and the System conference at the Renaissance Esmeralda Resort and Spa, Indian Wells, California. And I'll get you the organization name and a website a little later on. I'm sorry, I don't have it right now. And Sarah Palin, being gay is a choice. The search is on. You want to see something really funny, go into Google and type Sarah Palin's gay friend. Because nobody knows who this friend of hers is who made the choice to be gay. And like, yeah, it's just a choice, you understand. And he says sarcastically, number one. And number two, there's a whole bunch of people who are saying, I'll be your gay friend. Yeah. It's downright strange. It's downright strange. And a time for our Silvio Berlusconi alert for the day. Silvio Berlusconi, the small-time crook and small businessman who bought a radio station and then a TV station and then a newspaper and then another radio station and then a third radio station and then a fourth and then a fifth and then a second television station, and then another newspaper, and then bought a radio network, and then bought a TV network, and then bought the other radio network, and then the other TV network, and ended up owning over 90% of all the media that people watch, read, or listen to in Italy, and then ran for prime minister. And what a surprise, he won. Well, he's in hot water over use of a state helicopter to pick him up from a health farm following a private visit. Yeah. A whole big kerfuffle going on in Italy about Silvio using the $5 million state-owned helicopter to go to a fat farm, or a health farm, I guess, is what they're calling it. Anyhow, back to 1931. This is where it starts to get really fascinating. Skepticism as to President Hoover's plan to liquidate frozen bank assets. I shared this with you just before the break. Was expressed yesterday by Charles G. Edwards. The constructive value of the Hoover proposals was stressed by other prominent real estate men here yesterday. Much depends upon the details of how the plan will operate, they declared. Gee, where have you heard this before? Improvement in business conditions are necessary before real estate can improve. In the opinion of Lawrence Ellman, president of Pease and Ellman, the Hoover plan will relieve the general situation immediately or at least stop the downward plunge, according to Douglas Ellman, of Element and Company. The plan is undoubtedly a step in the right direction, said Mr. Elliman. It is bound to ease the situation everywhere. Psychologically, it will do much more good. So what is this? The system will make it possible for the Federal Reserve Bank to issue acceptance notes against sound real estate securities, thus stabilizing their values. Real estate mortgages are commonly regarded in banking as frozen assets. The Hoover Plan seeks to take these substantial investments from the frozen asset class and give them a recognized value. Published October 8, 1931 in the New York Times. So Herbert Hoover said he's going to create this thing called the Reconstruction Finance Administration, and what it's going to do is it's going to dump taxpayer money into the banking system specifically to unfreeze mortgages as a result of the housing bubble that burst in 1927 through 29. Here's another interesting one. That was from October 8th. 10 days later, October 18, 1931. What did Herbert Hoover think would solve the problems of the nation? The headline, Californians See Hoover, he tells group, taxes must be eased. The president told them, according to Mr. Vandegrift, that he was convinced that real estate and agriculture must be relieved of their tax burdens to bring about economic recovery. Yes, Herbert Hoover's plan to solve the problems of America, number one, bail out the banks, number two, cut taxes. Now we go to Christmas, the day before Christmas, 1931, December 24th. The headline, Mellon endorses $500 million fund. That would be about $500 billion in today's money. Favorable report on $100 billion for capital for land banks expected when Congress reassembles. These are the subheads. Secretary Mellon, this is the Secretary of the Treasury, same guy as Hank Paulson, has written a letter to Senator Norbeck, Republican of South Dakota, chairman of the Banking and Currency Committee, endorsing the plan for the $500 million Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which President Hoover has asked Congress to create as part of his program for economic relief. The secretary said, the mere existence of such an instrumentality, furnished with adequate resources and enabled to deal with any weaknesses that may develop in our credit structure, should have a reassuring effect on public confidence and be a stimulating influence on the resumption of the normal flow of credit in the channels of trade and commerce. You know, Henry Paulson should not have speechwriters. All he needs to do is go back and get Secretary Mellon's speeches and recite them. A favorable report to the Senate on the bill to increase the capitalization of federal land banks by $100 million or more is expected when Congress reassembles after the holiday recess. These were banks that principally loaned to farmers. They wanted to give them the equivalent of $100 billion in today's money. I'm just using, you know, a rough multiplier of about 100 to 1, which is actually reasonably accurate. The Senate bill is expected to differ from that passed by the House by making authorized increases in capital of $125 million instead of only $100 million. Chester Gray, representing the American Farm Federation, testified in favor of the $100 million increase in land bank capitalization, but opposed a moratorium of 5 years on farm debts. In other words, don't stop the foreclosing the farmers. This is the guy who's the head of the banking corporation, right? We gotta be able to foreclose it. Don't help the little guy. A third project to come before the Banking and Currency Committee will be a bill introduced in the closing hour of last night's sessions by Senator La Follette, asking a $5.5 billion prosperity bond issued for public works. Yeah, that went nowhere. I can tell you that right now. Okay, so here we are. Christmas, this is actually the same day, 1931. Hoover reassured by Senate leaders. Committee of both parties in White House talk promised a speed economic program. President stresses his interest in general principles and need to push restoring of business. In a last-minute effort to expedite Senate action on his economic program, President Hoover called on the White House this morning to leaders of both parties in the Senate and pressed on them to the need for prompt action on the debt postponement, the Federal Land Bank, and the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the three items in his plan for the restoration of normal business conditions. The president called these senators into Congress conference to urge upon them the necessity of the most expeditious portion of the economic program, Mr. Newton stated. Meanwhile, in Syracuse, New York, on December 24th, the day before Christmas, President Hoover had recently opposed any legislation that would cut wages of executives in business. So the Syracuse Police Department took a cue from this. This is from the New York Times, December 25, 1931. Syracuse Police today, quote, respectfully declined, end quote, to accept Mayor Roland B. Marvin's proposal for a 10% voluntary reduction in salary of city employees. The mayor told them he gave them until 2 p.m. Saturday to change their mind. If they do not, he said, I will act. The mayor did not indicate today what his action may be if the police stand is unchanged. The policeman's committee, waiting upon the mayor, cited recent utterances of President Hoover against wage cuts in corporate America in support of their stand. Forms to be signed, but you know, it goes on. So, interesting. Then the compromise move fails. Hoover assails lending to anyone, to one of any conceivable security. So what happened was the Democrats said, okay, fine, you can have your Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but we wanted to give money to the average person, not to the bankers. And Hoover says, no way, no way. I will veto that sucker if you do it that way. And the type is getting small here. I'm having to double up my glasses for those of you watching on the video stream. Hey. Differences over the unemployment relief bill flared in open conflict today between President Hoover and Speaker Garner. Garner, by the way, was the guy who ended up running as vice president under Roosevelt. Democratic nominee for the vice presidency. Speaker Garner took the floor in the House to receive an ovation from the Democrats when he asked for their support in what he called a battle against class legislation desired by the president. The Republican Hoover, objected to provision in the bill. He said, he declared unequivocally that he would not agree to the policy of lending money to, quote, individuals, partnerships, states, and municipalities on any conceivable kind of security for any purpose, end quote. It's quoting President Hoover. In other words, you can't use this money to help out the states. You can't use this money to help out the cities. You can't use this money to help out individuals. You can only help out the banks. The measure would make the Reconstruction Corporation the most gigantic banking and pawnbroking business in all of history, the president asserted, if the Democrats put these changes into it, which, by the way, FDR eventually did, and that's how he saved America. President Hoover, in his statement, laid the blame for the failure of the meetings last night on Speaker Garner. Yeah, it was all political, right? This is just incredible. It's like it's all over again. New difficulties loom, however, a threat from Representative LaGuardia to head a House movement to vote for direct relief of $300 million and to limit the Reconstruction Finance Corporation loans to new projects and not only for dead bonds. Let's not just bail out the bankers. Okay, I think I've given you all of it. I'll take your calls after the break.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Another song down memory lane with GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew and that I lied to you. But I'm not the only one hiding smoking guns. Smoke in your eyes. But that's cause you get news from your TV and they cover up for me.
Okay, enough, George. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. There's one more. This is back when we actually had progressive Republicans. They put together a bill. It was passed 43-31. It passed by a majority in the Senate. Relief bill passed by. So this is in July of 1932. This is, you know, Herbert Hoover is president. The Republicans control the House and Senate. And Garner was the chairman of the Senate. I'll have to check on that, or the Speaker of the House, rather. Maybe the Democrats are controlling the House. I'd have to go back and check. In any case, Hoover is the president, supported by 14 Republican votes. The conference report on the Garner-Wagner 2,100,000. This looks like $2,100,000,000 relief bill was adopted in the Senate today, and congressional action on its measure was thus completed. The vote was 43-31. The bill will be sent to the president Monday for a veto, which will admittedly be sustained. So here's what this bill did is here. Senator Norbeck explained briefly the provisions of the compromise bill, including $300 million for loans for the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to states for immediate relief work, appropriation of $322 million for roads and public works and Reconstruction Finance Corporation loans of $1.5 billion to states, municipalities, public and private corporations, and individuals on proper security for the advancement of employment. The breach between Democrats in Congress and Mr. Hoover resulted from the last of these three sections drawn by Speaker Garner and opposed by the president on the grounds that it, quote, this is Hoover speaking, makes the Reconstruction Corporation the most gigantic banking and pawnbroking business in all history, end quote. In other words, they're bailing out the little guy. You can't do that. Senator Wagner opened fire on this contention, quoting Mr. Hoover's annual message to Congress last December as recommending that the Reconstruction Corporation be authorized to advance loans to, quote, established industries which could not otherwise obtain credit, end quote. Mr. Wagner continued, more recently, when the president issued his denunciation of the Garner bill because of its so-called pork barrel features, there was not a suggestion of objection to loans to private banking industries. Later, Mr. Johnson declared that this relief bill was designed to help the forgotten man, an allusion that brought to mind Franklin D. Roosevelt's declarations. Yeah. But Hoover vetoed it. Roosevelt came into power. He passed it. He signed it. It got passed again. He signed it and thus began putting back together America. The Republicans today and many of the Democrats are repeating the mistakes of the Republicans in 1931 and 32. They're exactly repeating the mistakes. It's like history repeats itself. It is so eerie. It's almost creepy. Jeremy in Huntington Beach. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
Basically, you know, you're actually right about there's so few actual progressive Democrats. I feel privileged to have, like, Barbara Boxer here on the West Coast.
Well, but, back then, I mean, 14 of these Republicans in the Senate were called themselves progressives. This is, you know, following Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, they would never sign a Roosevelt bill because if you understand what happened after that, like in the 60s, I mean, you know, people they think are scum are starting to get in and press their demands. I mean, you know, when you have a middle class nice and fat and happy and they send their kids to good schools, they start actually demanding things, and you can't have that.
That's exactly right, Jeremy. And in fact, if I can just riff on that for a second, I'll give it back to you. That, in my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, in that book, I lay that out, that the reason why the conservatives were so freaked out that in 1980, when they took power, they started deconstructing the middle class, is because they correctly noticed that whenever the middle class had a reasonable amount of wealth and safety and security, as happened in the 1770s and as happened again in the 1960s, whenever that middle class gets like that, they get a little rowdy. And Jefferson thought it was a fine thing. And most of us in the 60s thought it was a fine thing. It was a good for democracy. But the conservatives thought this is unstable and stability is the most important thing. So we've got to wipe out that middle class. Back to you.
Well, anyone that's wondering might want to look at the horse's mouth itself. There's a paper written by Samuel Huntington called The Crisis of Democracy, written in the 70s, based on Walter Lippmann, Harold Laswell, and all of these people. I mean, anyone that really wonders how this works should really read any and all of that, you know. These are people who are on the left wing of the spectrum of their time, at least, who thought, yeah, basically you can't have the middle class in on decision-making because, you know, it'll be anarchy.
Right,
you know,
these are the people who became the neocons. Huntington was one of the founders of the neoconservative movement.
Right. Well, of his time, though, he was thought to be pretty progressive. But I mean,
yep.
Walter Lippmann, Harold Laswell, Edward Bernays, I mean, anyone that really wants to look at how it works should really look into these people and read it from the horse's
mouth. Leo Strauss.
What's that?
Leo Strauss.
I haven't read him.
Yeah. Well, Leo Strauss is the godfather of the whole thing. He's from the University of Chicago. But excellent point. Excellent point and very well said, Jeremy. Thank you very much. And Samuel Huntington, The Crisis of Democracy, I'm going to track it down. That's one that somehow I missed. We're pretty much out of time here for this hour. We'll be back, you know, after the break. But let me just wrap this up. And so I don't want to put a caller on with 20 seconds to go. It wouldn't be fair to you. But here's the bottom line. If you want an economy to work, you have to drive it from the bottom up. If we increase the minimum wage, if we pass the Employee Free Choice Act so you had more people unionized, but let's balance out the power of corporate power with the power of labor. Very straightforward stuff. This is the stuff that Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s, in the mid-1930s, that restored America, that brought America back, that brought back our country. It's really not rocket science. We can do it again. But the way you don't do it is handing millions, billions, or trillions of dollars off to banks and nothing to the average person. It's got to be done in a way that it drives from the bottom up rather than the top down. It's just a very simple analysis. Bottom up works, top down doesn't. As 1932 showed us, 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, we're heading toward the debate between Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. And Gwen Ifill has this book coming out, The Age of Obama, for Inauguration Day, apparently. And Pat Drudge is just beating her over the head with this thing. It's going to be very interesting to see if she survives this firestorm that the Reich is ginning up. Meanwhile, in Troopergate, apparently Sarah Palin not only got this guy fired, her brother-in-law, ex-brother-in-law, but even went to the point of going to the people who administer unemployment benefits and health benefits and, you know, claims like that, and tried to get him denied benefits. It's truly, truly, truly strange. Meanwhile, the New York Times reporting, and this is, you know, having spent most of the day yesterday in the Times archives from 28 to 32, it's like eerie. I just have to tell you, because, I just spent almost an hour reading to you from the New York Times, which I realize pretty much violates every rule of radio. But hopefully it was as enlightening to you as it was to me. I mean, it was just startling. You look at today's New York Times, the top story, the electronic version, nytimes.com, failed deals replace boom in New York real estate. After 7 years of nonstop construction and skyrocketing rents and sale prices, the credit crisis is bringing an end to the city's real estate boom. This is what I was telling you about yesterday. I mean, this credit crisis is bringing an end to a lot of booms. Or it's frankly, it may bring the end to a lot of businesses. It's going to be this is a tough time for a lot of companies that depend on credit. Like, for example, the Salem Children's Village, salemchildrensvillage.org, that depends largely on state funding, and the state goes late, and so they pull a little money from a line of credit against the land they own, and the bank is like, well, I don't know. We got no money. The Senate is going to vote today on the bailout plan. Senate leaders agreed to add tax breaks. And see, remember 1931, Herbert Hoover? He said, what's the solution to the crisis, to the depression? Tax breaks. That was Herbert Hoover's suggestion. You heard me read the story right here. Senate leaders agreed to add tax breaks and a higher limit for insured bank deposits. Now, that's a good idea. That's actually something that Franklin Roosevelt put into place. The FDIC was created, as I recall, in 1936, might have been 35, by the Roosevelt administration, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and with this limit of $100,000, which in today's money would be closer to $1 million. So really raising it to $250,000 doesn't even take it up to what it was in Roosevelt's mind in order to stop runs on banks. And so that's a great idea. And Barack Obama came out with that suggestion. He's out there pushing this bailout plan. And, you know, I'm not going to take him on for that. The problem is, here's the good news and the bad news, if you want, as it were, as they say. The good news is that if this bailout plan passes, it'll buy a little time. It will help things a little bit over the short term. Just like when Herbert Hoover got the Reconstruction Finance Corporation passed and gave $100 million to the banks, it bought him a little time. He tried to give, you know, be buying enough time to get up to the election. Didn't quite work. So, excuse me, getting distracted here. But so here we are now with Obama. Oh, not so much Obama. It's just right across the board. The Republicans and Democrats. The good news is that it will buy some time. The bad news is that it will buy some time. Because that's what the Republicans want. What the Republicans are desperate for is to buy enough time to get to the election. Because they know this thing is going to go south. Here, I mean, the other story from the front page of the New York Times, Ford's U.S. sales fell 34% in September. Sales are predicted to be substantially lower at other major automakers who will be reporting sales later on Wednesday. Tighter credit only adds to auto industry's troubles. That's the bottom line, is that we've been, you know, for the last 20, 30 years, as a result of deregulation and easy money, as a result in large part of Alan Greenspan's policies, we've seen a boom. The stock market was, you know, when Carter left office, when Reagan came into office, I mean, it's, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, I think it was in the low 3,000s when Bill Clinton came into office. Now it's at 13,000. Well, now it's at 10,000. You know, it's flirted with 13. It's at 10,769 right now. It's down 80 points. But that's a hell of a boom, actually, over a 30-year period. And, you know, the ride's coming to an end. And I would not be in the stock market. I've been saying that for 6 years, and it's going to be a rough ride, I think, for a while. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Let's bring you into this. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for going back to in history.
You're welcome.
To that crash, but
it was like stepping into the Wayback Machine, you know.
Well, I talked to my parents. They're both gone now. And they remember the bread lines. It was a horrible time.
Yes.
And they didn't have the luxuries that we had. They had outdoor toilets.
Yeah.
I mean, we're used to all this luxury. And it could
well,
be.
There's a flip side to that, though, Flo. They had something that we don't have. They, when the Great Depression happened, the United States was producing 100% of its own oil. So we didn't have to import oil from anybody, number
mm-hmm.
one. Number two, we were manufacturing virtually everything that we used. We made our own clothes here. We made our own cars here. We made our own radios here. You know, RCA was one of the big explosive stocks in the late 20s in the stock market. We pretty much made everything right here in the United States for the United States. And we no longer have that industrial infrastructure. We no longer have that manufacturing capacity. And we no longer are drilling, you know, are using our own oil. We're importing, you know, oil from all over the world. And the other thing is, in 1931, we weren't in debt to anybody. This country was not broke. We were a mm-hmm. substantial creditor. In fact, Germany was in debt to us to the tune of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, as I recall from the Treaty of Versailles. And
we didn't have the wars going on. We were getting over World War One.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that we had everything was in place to rebuild the country. All we needed to do was stop tossing money at the very rich, which is what Hoover did in 29, 30, 31, and early 32, and start moving money to the bottom of the pile, start rebuilding our infrastructure, start, you know, put people back to work, which is what Roosevelt did in 33, 34, 35, 36, and got us out of the Great Depression.
Where's our FDR, though?
Well, I think it might be Barack Obama. And frankly, I think that the Democrats who are buying this stuff of, you know, let's bail out the rich. I mean, you know, over the short term and before the election, I'll give it to them. You know, no problem. We're talking a mind-boggling amount of money, but we're not talking about something that's going to make it impossible for the government to do anything. But broadly speaking, after the election, we need to mobilize a national progressive majority to move this country in a progressive direction to
Can
put
I
us back
Can I tell you something, though? This is
yeah.
the reason why I called.
Sure.
I was listening to radio news, and they said today, starting today, there's a $300 billion bailout for mortgages that are in trouble. It was the money was already issued through Congress, and it's backed by the FHA. So the only problem is you can go to get a smaller loan to your bank, but it's up to them to give the loan out. If they don't want to, you don't get a smaller loan. It's called Hope for Homeowners.
Okay, I'll have to check that out, Flo. That's something that flew right by my radar.
Yeah, it was on the CBS Radio News with Harley Carnes earlier, about 1 o'clock.
I'll check it out. Flo, thank you very much for the call, and I appreciate the tip. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. My problem is that when I called my congressperson here in the North Seattle suburbs, Congressman Rick Larson, who's a Democrat, but he also voted for the bankruptcy bill.
Right.
He voted for this bailout. And when you call his office, it's like the staffers, the people that answer the phone, they like attack you if you disagree with them about why he's supporting the bailout. And they're trying to say, well, the president gave us a blank check, and now we Democrats have put all these controls in, like executive compensation, you know, we're curbing the
those things are all true, Anthony, and I think for right now we need to, as much as if I were in Congress right now, I would vote against this. I would even vote against the new and improved version. But I'm not strongly opposed to it like I was the FISA legislation. I just think it's not going to solve the problem. It's only going to buy them enough time to get the Republicans to the election. So, but, you know, I'd cut them some slack right now. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, I tracked down the Hope for Homeowners program, and the problem, this is from the New York Times, Tara Siegel-Bernard writing in the New York Times 2 days ago, in the Your Money column. The problem with the Hope for Homeowners program, consumer advocates said, is that participation is entirely voluntary. The other problem is that these mortgages have been sliced and diced into so many pieces that it's hard to pull them all back together again. The third problem is that bankruptcy law says that a bankruptcy judge can't modify the terms of your principal mortgage. They can modify the terms of a secondary mortgage, your vacation home. So if, you know, wealthy people with 5-10 homes go into, like, you know, if John McCain were to go into bankruptcy all but his primary residence, he could modify those mortgages, but not on your primary mortgage. And we need to modify our bankruptcy laws in this regard. But the financial services industry is fighting that tooth and nail. So we'll see. We'll see where this thing goes. Mike in Vancouver, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Mike, what's up? Oh, listen to KPHA if you're in Vancouver. What's up, Mike?
Yeah, I just was going to make the comment that while I think Tina Fey may be more qualified to be VP than Sarah Palin, we should draw on her executive experience and run the federal budget like she does the Alaska budget. That is, let the oil companies pay for 85% of it.
Right. You know what would be funny is if, after the debate, if Joe Biden got together with Tina Fey for a Saturday Night Live skit. Because I could just see him, you know, reprising the debate, revisiting the debate. But, yeah, by the way, and thank you, Mike. By the way, if you watch, and it's very easy to find these on YouTube, you can just kind of essentially Google for them. Or YouTube for them or whatever, the debates that Sarah Palin had when she was running for governor of Alaska. She's a damn good debater. A couple days ago, 3, 4, 5 days ago, or over the weekend, I watched about an hour of her debating. And what she's the master of is the non-answer answer. She takes a specific issue, and her opponents go through all these details, you know, that just kind of make your eyes cross, and she'll come out with some generality about, oh, yeah, well, that shows how free we are. And everybody goes, oh, well, that's nice. So anyway, that's the problem Joe Biden's going to have. Scott in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing this afternoon?
Just great.
I just kind of wanted to pick your brain on your thoughts if, you know, if this whole economy does slide into a depression. Yesterday you were talking about how we need to maybe reboot things.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with rebooting the American psyche. And shaking us to our roots might really kind of bring us around and bring us to start solving some real problems that we need to solve.
You know, my wife Louise's grandmother was 95 years old when she died. Must have been about 5 or 6 years ago when we were living in Vermont. And she was, you know, living near us. And she was sharp as a tack right up until just a few months before she died. And she used to say, and with some startling regularity, she lived through the Great Depression. She had a farm in Michigan and was relatively self-sufficient. You know, she bought sugar and salt and a dress every year from Sears and Roebuck, and that was about it. But she used to say, we need a depression in the United States to cause us to this is my language, not hers. I don't remember her exact phrase. But basically recalibrate our values of what's important and what's not. Her point was that during the Great Depression, community was highly valued. People worked together.
Yeah.
People pulled together. And she had been looking at America since Reagan, and the whole greed is good and the explosion of wealth and the, you know, everything else, and just, you know, was saying that, you know, she was seeing a country that had lost its way, and that she felt that a Great Depression would bring it back. It's awful strong medicine. I mean,
it is, but something to shake us away from our TVs and our Big Macs and shake us into knocking on our neighbors' doors.
But the problem is, I mean, there are tens of millions of Americans who are right now suffering terribly.
I hear you.
And that number is going to go up. It's going to more than double. It's going to go up exponentially if we slide into the kind of depression that I frankly think we are. And it will not be an easy solution. The good news is that if Barack Obama is elected president and we can get a progressive majority behind him, rather than having 3 years of a do-nothing presidency and Congress like the United States did from 1929 until 1932, I mean, Hoover wasn't inaugurated until, you know, January of 33, or was it March back then? No, I think it was January then. And instead of that, we'll have just a few months of this, and Obama can hit the ground running in January and start repairing the damage and get Congress together to do it. But I think, Scott, that it's going to take things getting, if not a lot worse, at least a lot scarier before the Democrats in Congress will be so shaken that they start behaving like the Democrats did in the 1930s and actually solve these problems at the level of the ground rather than the air, if you know what I mean. At the bottom, because that's really the only way that we can do it is from the bottom up. We can't do it from the top down.
No,
it's
I agree
be
with
down.
You 100%.
And it's just, yeah, Scott, thanks a lot for the call. I just, you know, this, you look I'm looking at the headlines on today's New York Times. Failed deals replace boom in New York real estate. Ford's U.S. sales fall 34%. And it's anyhow. Oh, some interesting things I found when I was looking through the New York Times. July 10th, 1932. President Hoover has always wanted the nation's capital to be a model city. He had this in mind today when he signed an act to regulate traffic in firearms in the District of Columbia, provides penalties of up to 30 years in prison for crimes of violence in which guns are used, makes it harder to buy a pistol.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour, Sarah Palin. What a hoot. I think this was on Hugh Hewitt's show, or was it Dennis Prager? One of those Salem guys she was on. And here she is talking about how she was having a hard time getting health insurance until she got a good union job.
I like the idea of just an everyday working class American running for such an office. But, yeah, there's been a lot of times that Todd and I have had to figure out how we were going to pay for health insurance. We've gone through periods of our life here with paying out of pocket for health coverage until Todd and I both landed a couple of good union jobs early on in our marriage. We didn't have to.
There you go. Until we landed a couple of good union jobs. That's what it took. Yeah. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Matt in Oakland, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Great show. And just my own opinion, I think reading the newspapers to give that perspective makes for fine radio.
Oh, thank you.
But I just wanted to offer a perspective. I was lucky enough to be able to travel to Sweden this summer for a family reunion, and en route stopped in Iceland and observed there what seems to have been a kind of crashing halt in a construction boom that had been taking place. When I spoke to a Swedish relative who's an accountant and kind of follows European banking really closely, he said that the Icelandic banks, as with all over Europe, had been closely tied to the subprime mess and had been experiencing a major slowdown. So just kind of, I'm always curious to hear more about the...
They had their own. They actually had a banking crash in Sweden in 1998, and it was tied to a housing bubble. And what the Swedish government did is they bought up the companies that were going under, the principally the banks. There were some investment houses as well. They actually bought them up and owned them. They went in and they fired senior management or took out senior management who had made the lousy decisions. And when they sold them, they made a profit on it. And that's what Sweden did. And in fact, if you just Google Sweden, you know, bank bailout or Sweden, you know, recovery, stuff like that. I mean, the story, in fact, the couple, 3-4 months ago, the former finance minister for Sweden, whose name escapes me at the moment, but it's one of those like Bjorn, somebody, you know, is a very Scandinavian name, was traveling around Washington, D.C., trying to buttonhole any legislator who would listen to tell him, hey, you know, we know how to do this. We figured this out. So Matt, good one. Excellent one. Ken in West Palm Beach. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I want to thank you for your wealth of knowledge that you give us.
That's quite right. It's unnecessary.
Ken, American hero.
You can get right to let's get right to the point here. What's up?
McCain, you know, no one's mentioned that his wife, wherever he's at, she's there at his side constantly. He
That's
because
he flies around on her jet.
Pardon?
That's because he flies around on her private jet, and if they don't want to have anybody pay for it, she's got to be in the plane.
Well, I think maybe there's another reason. I think maybe that he might need help. There was a comment this morning on a news program that... he got lost getting off the stage.
Yeah.
And she wasn't next to him.
Yeah.
Maybe he's lost some of his peripheral vision through maybe a stroke, or some people have mentioned that he's got a bad twitch in his eye or something.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of good reasons, Ken, for us to say we want to know what his medical status is. The guy is 72 years old, and he's talking about Sarah Palin having her finger on the nuclear trigger and having to negotiate with Vladimir Putin. And that, I think, to most Americans is one hell of a scary idea. Jovanka, am I pronouncing that right in Sunrise?
Close, Jovanka.
Jovanka, welcome.
thank you for calling.
What's on your mind, Jovanka?
Well, I wanted to say, by the way, thank you for reading the New York Times articles from the late 20s and early 30s. It's really scary how a lot of what was said back then is being said now.
I know, word for word.
Yes, especially by John McCain, but then again, he probably has clippings from that time. So
he probably remembers that time.
I think so, too.
He's just reciting it from memory.
But I wanted to mention, you had talked about the STET tax last week.
Yeah.
And
The securities transfer estate tax, or excise tax. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I decided after hearing a little bit about it on TV, I called the Obama campaign and spoke. I mean, I figured I'm not going to get through to Senator Obama, obviously, but I wanted to, you know, to kind of make clear that that's something that Senator Obama, I think it would help him not only with the election, but in the eyes of the undecided who really, really are against this bailout. I myself was against the bailout as well. I think that if he were to mention that, immediately people would start to see that he, which he does, that he really does care about what's going on with the economy, and that it would be something that immediately every single, even the House Republicans that were against it, would be able to say, now there's something that saves the taxpayers. I think that...
Although the Republican line would be, oh, yeah, this is the typical Democratic response. We need more taxes. Right? I mean, you can see it coming, you can hear it coming, you know that that's,
yeah,
that's going to be the response. And unfortunately, because there are, you know, 40 plus or minus, you know, half a dozen or so, but more or less a little more than 40 very, very conservative, very anti-tax Democrats in the House of Representatives, there's not a solid majority, and the idea of liberal or moderate Republicans is long gone. They've all been purged from the party. There's not a solid majority in the House right now, which is where all taxing legislation has to originate, that would be in favor of this. And Peter DeFazio, Congressman Peter DeFazio, is the guy who's, and Marcy Kaptur, whose name I mangled earlier, are leading the charge for this thing in the House of Representatives. But, you know, we'll see how it shakes out. But Jovanka, thanks for letting the Obama campaign know, and keep on spreading the word.
If I just may make one
sure.
more point very quickly, I know you have a lot of people waiting. Sarah Palin, you know, as a woman, I applaud that she wants to run for the highest, second highest office in the land. But as a Jewish American, I have a problem with that, with her comments and her association with that church. You know, how can somebody who says she has more foreign policy experience than Barack Obama and Joe Biden, you know, belong or even listen to the kind of comments that have been made? And, you know, nobody's really talking about that. That's something, especially in this time when Israel is experiencing a political shift with their prime ministers and also the increase in violence in the Middle East. I wonder why, aside from programs on Air America and 940 Winds where I listen, especially with your show, that no one's talking about this more. It's an issue. If she becomes vice president, you know, heaven forbid, she most likely could become president within John McCain's first term. And that's something that just, it's scary that no one's talking about more about the foreign policy and her real true views on Israel. I mean, it's really scary.
And her apocalyptic visions and all those kind of things. Jovanka,
exactly.
I've got to move along, but thank you very much. Well said. In fact, we have a little bit of tape from the debate prep sessions that are happening at John McCain's home with Sarah Palin. Here's the audio. Ah, yes. Diction.
In Hartford, Hereford, and Hampshire.
Of you to let me come.
Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the
plain. Oh, yeah. So our special little insight into our hidden microphone. Yeah. Gina in Salinas, California. Hey, Gina?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
You know, all that information you gave stops at the point to where you get to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, it's looking like to me, is the funnel for all of the money that's gone out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just a military-industrial thing, it's the finances hooked to it.
Yeah, it's a military-industrial banking congressional complex.
It's,
and media complex,
okay.
Actually. It's...
In July 2008, I ran across a newsletter, an A-letter,
mm-hmm.
okay, from... the Sovereign Society, and it said that in 61 days, oh, Congress does what it does best, spend money. In 61 days, there's going to be an avalanche of cash, okay, flow out of
the United States.
Out of the United States,
mm-hmm.
okay. Now, I heard, I think it was Andy Gauss say that they wanted us to borrow money to pay this off from the Sovereign Wealth Fund.
Right. We're the bailout, they've very explicitly said, Gina, and Paulson laid this out, and they're actually, I'm surprised that they're not even trying to hide it. The fact that much, if not all, of this $700 billion that we're talking about might end up in the hands of people in China and Saudi Arabia and other countries. We're basically bailing out the rest of the world. Why? Because we're in debt to the rest of the world, which we weren't in 1932. George in Seattle, we have just a minute before the break, Georgia. What's up?
Yeah, Mr. Hartman.
Yes,
boy,
sir.
You're so true.
I'm
about
true.
What you said about the Depression.
Do you remember it?
Oh yeah, I'm 81 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
And my brother and I, we survived, my parents, in Stockton, California, 1927.
Yep. So you remember the Great Depression, and my characterization of it is accurate in your opinion.
For Obama. When I come home from Germany in 1945, I voted one time for Republican Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, I got laid off.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm retired now from Boeing, and now Boeing's on strike.
Yep, they are. George, thank you very much for listening, and thank you for the affirmation of our analysis of what's going on. It's good to hear from you, and thanks for calling, and good on you for a good long life and for serving in World War II as well. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the No Boring Zone. Stick around. I think Ellen Ratner's up.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Paycheck just ain't stretching like it matter once before. Cause the good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss is cut to that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets cause their boat's the same as yours. That is one big union.
Yeah, that's America. It should be one big union. 9.5 minutes before the hour.
Baby, take off your coat.
Oh, it's our full Monty alert. A Chicago artist is drawing crowds to his bar.
Baby, take off your shoes.
This is the Old Town Ale House on Chicago's north side. Last Thursday put up a portrait, a 4-foot-tall portrait,
baby, take off your
of Governor Sarah Palin in the buff with a rifle on a bear rug. Oh, my. Also in Taipei, my full Monty alert part two. Police in southern Taiwan are looking for a man who rode his motorcycle naked through the city's main streets for an hour, according to TV reports. Yeah, how did they find out? Well, people caught him on their cell phone cameras. It's a whole new world. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, big doings here in Washington. The Republican and Democratic Governors Association, they can't stand each other, but they came out with a joint statement to support the bailout that isn't a bailout.
Oh, interesting. The bailout that's a rescue, you mean?
The bailout that's exactly that, a rescue.
Yeah.
The president had lunch today with Secretary Paulson and Bernanke, and they Tony Fredo talked about how they expect that there's going to be an extension of some of these renewals, particularly wind and solar and power protection for the people hit by the alternative minimum tax, FDIC reform, and the increase of $250,000 as the top. Now, it's very interesting because there have been people like Alan Blinder, famous during the Clinton administration, now a professor at Princeton, that said this will just get the banks to behave more irresponsibly.
Yeah. You know, Paul Krugman made the point in his blog that, well, here's the quote, Albinora in our chat room posted this into the chat.
Right.
The true cost to taxpayers will probably be close to zero, and it would buy some time, but I'm not passionate about this. The real financial rescue still lies in the future, probably under the Obama administration. I think that we're looking at a replay of the 30s all over again, and if Obama comes in and does the things that FDR did, he can put this country back together in a fraction of the time. You know, FDR for 3 years basically did nothing, and America crumbled. And fortunately, we don't have 3 more years of George W. Bush.
No, fortunately, we do not. The one thing, of course, that's a lasting legacy of those of the WPA administrations, we had some beautiful art, but that's about maybe.
Well, and bridges and dams
and forests.
We'll
get some of that stuff.
And parks and
No, they did some amazing stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Amazing
stuff. Put America back to work. The problem that Obama has that Franklin Roosevelt didn't have is that when Franklin Roosevelt was set about to put America back together, number one, our country was not in debt. In fact, other countries, notably Germany, owed us money, number one. So we weren't broke, and we're broke now. We've got 30 years of Republicans who have broken us. Number two, we were not importing our energy supplies. We 100% of the oil used in the United States came from the United States because, we hadn't hit peak oil. We hit peak oil in the United States in 74. And so now we have to import, 60% of our oil, I think it is now. Number three, we made almost everything in the United States that we used in the United States. We made our own clothes. We made our own cars. We made our own, we didn't have computers, but our electronics to the extent that we had them, radios and things like that. We made our own houses. We made our own building materials.
No, we certainly controlled our means of production. So.
That's right. That's right. And all three of those basic core pillars of an economy have been, bundled up and hauled off by the Dick Cheneys of the world, whose company Halliburton has now even moved its headquarters to the Middle East.
Right.
I mean, they're gone.
They certainly have.
Yeah. Sarah Palin, by the way.
I see them.
You get to Dubai. Did you see Sarah Palin's interview last night?
I did. I was getting my nails done, but the nail place has it. It was she couldn't name her news sources.
Right. And she says that for the last 30 years, her best friend, she has a best friend who's gay.
Yeah, who's gay, who made the choice.
Right, who made the choice.
I nearly fell off my chair.
And what's so funny, Ellen, is if you Google Sarah Palin's gay friend, you get hundreds of people who put video blogs up now saying, I'll be Sarah Palin's gay friend. Here's my qualifications. It's great.
That is hilarious.
We should have a competition for who wants to be Sarah's gay friend, because they can't find this person. Nobody can find this person she referred to who's been her best friend for 30 years.
I thought, why didn't she say at least her first name? I thought it was strange, to say the least. A couple other interesting things. Today, David McKinnon, who, as you know, is sort of commanding the U.S. troops for NATO in Afghanistan, said that they do need more troops there. He said, Afghanistan is not like Iraq. It's more complex. And he talked about governance issues and the police force. Now, my cousin Richard Miller was there, and he talked about, pretty recently, as you may recall, and he talked about bashish, which is how you can't even get out of the airport in the country without paying somebody off.
Yeah.
So if you talk about governance issues and police force, that's code for corrupt, corrupt, corrupt.
Right. What we need to do in Afghanistan is the same thing that Hezbollah did in southern Lebanon, which is rebuild it. We need to bring money in. We need to start. We need to do what Franklin Roosevelt did in the United States, and have them embrace us because we're the ones who built their hospitals and their schools and their infrastructure, rather than try to bomb them. Frankly, in my opinion. But anyhow, Ellen, thanks so much for being
here. Thank you.
Great talking with you. Ellen Radner, talkradionews.com is the website for the Talk Radio News Service. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Wall Street Journal columnist and former special assistant to the president during the Reagan years, Peggy Noonan. Her new book, Patriotic Grace, talks about post-election unity. Is it possible? Is it even a good idea? Plus, Naomi Wolf is going to join us in the studio. Should be great. Don't forget, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.